Good morning, Tucson, Arizona. Welcome to The Morning Voice. I am your host, Grant Kruger. Excited to be here with you this Wednesday, July 2nd. I always get really excited for July. I know that sounds weird out there, you know, that a lot of people don't particularly care for the summer in Tucson, Arizona. But let me tell you, as a local restaurateur, July is absolutely awesome. Like, first and foremost, this is essentially Tucson's Ramadan, right? Like, there is a lot of people gone. So if you want to get a table at that hot restaurant you were trying to get into, think Frida or something like that on the east side, right? You want to get into Bata. Boy, there is no wait. You can walk right into Vivace on a Saturday night at 7:30 and get seated. And tell me that that isn't awesome. That's a great thing over there. Like, it's pretty neat to have. I love being able to drive through town and go down Speedway and not hit a light at every intersection. You know, Grant Road is still a hot mess. But for the most part, you can get
through. You're its namesake. They should do something special with it.
I think the city has actually purposely named Grant Road after me to leave it under construction and just be a terrible mess as a reminder of how much we often don't get along or aren't on the same side of politics over here, quite frankly. But in all honesty, Matt, I love July. I think that it's a great time of year for us to work on the restaurants, right, as opposed to in the business. And so it gives us opportunity to do physical repairs, painting, you know, maintenance, infrastructure, and even in some cases, closures. Like, you'll see a number of restaurants will actually hightail it out a week, particularly the 4th of July week. Like, this is one that you see a lot of people even possibly close and take a week off. If you're a sole proprietor, that might be something that you can do. We can't quite get away with that in my neck of the woods with a few hundred employees. They kind of depend on us to be open. And even while some of them, I'm sure, would enjoy a little bit of 4th of July break, it's not so easy to just shut down an operation of that size. But nonetheless, lots of neat things happening around July, not just our nation's 249th birthday, but yesterday was July 1st. It was Dominion Day. It was Canada's birthday for those keeping score at home.
It took them until 1980 to adopt O Canada as their national anthem.
Correct.
Even though, like, 120 some odd years.
So Canada's Dominion Day, now known as Canada Day, was actually started in 1867, right after the U.S. Civil War. And the word Dominion came from it was eventually replaced by the word federal, but it was to separate the federal government from the provinces at that time. And a few Canadian provinces declared their independence from England in 1867. So our neighbor to the north, Canada, is celebrating 158 years as we go for 249. So excited for those guys up there. I don't think they're going to end up being our 51st state, as previously stated. I'm actually a big fan, though, of Canada in general. They've been great ally of the United States. I'm a big fan of hockey. I grew up in the border town of Detroit, Michigan, right next to Canada. And so they do carry a soft spot.
Also known
in my
as
heart.
South Detroit, but, you know,
Born and raised in South Detroit. It was actually Northwest Detroit over there. It was just, you know, maybe unfortunate when I belt out those lyrics. I try to change it, but it doesn't quite have the same cadence, right? As born and raised in South Detroit. But nonetheless, that happens on July 1st. It's now known as Canada Day. They switched it from Dominion Day in 1982. So the first few years of my life, it was Dominion Day. Now it's Canada Day. That was yesterday. Pretty awesome. Also yesterday was Bobby Bonilla Day, right? Celebrating his $1.1 million paycheck. On probably one of the greatest deals in sports history, where you had an individual, like, rather than take the lump sum, actually took this series of payments. And aging Bobby Bonilla's got another 10 years on that deal, where he's getting over $1 million a year every single July 1st. So happy Bobby Bonilla Day.
That certainly became a meme. I mean, that was all over social media yesterday. It's just so funny how things kind of catch on as a meme with people.
But it was kind of a pro move on his part, right? Back in the days before really big contracts, he was able to figure out a way to take this, you know, series of payments. It's kind of interesting because when you think of athletes taking series of payments, what also started yesterday was the first day of NCAA athletes being paid.
Yes.
Right? The House versus NCAA settlement that we've talked about a couple of times on this show becomes effective as of yesterday. The University of Arizona is going to have to share $20.5 million between its various students. Student athletes, as they say.
You could hear it. Desiree Reed Francois and her staff were counting out $20.5 million yesterday. You could actually hear the cash rustling.
And so I wonder now if these new signings, right? If you, over the course of the weekend, the U of A announced that we signed Oscar Rios, a four-star quarterback, which is a pretty big haul for the U of A. At what point do we end up with a picture of that individual with the giant check? Like, I just won the golf tournament. Here's, you know, I have chosen the U of A. It's no longer going to be the baseball hat. It's going to be the giant check.
It's the publisher's clearinghouse check.
Right? I mean, we're there if they're getting paid. Like, I feel like this is something that probably should happen, like, right away. And it probably is happening, quite frankly, behind the scenes. Tell me that there wasn't a check somehow already delineated out for quarterback Oscar Rios before this decision was made, that he didn't know July 1st was coming and was going to sign right before this deal. I mean, I don't think there's any question that the public disclosure of these finances of what we're paying our student athletes is going to be really eye-opening. In fact, our coaches, right, the men's football and basketball coaches, are the highest paid employees in the entire state of Arizona. And because they're state employees, their salaries are public. And so this is going to be public knowledge what all these players are getting paid. And I, for one, am really keeping an eye on this one. I find it quite interesting. Normally on July 1st as well, too, it's Watermelon EG's Day, right, when they announce their flavor of the month. And it had always been watermelon. In recent years, EG's has chosen to release watermelon early. I actually got a proclamation from previous Mayor Rothschild back in like 2017 or 2018 when we broke some heat records that EG's had to release watermelon EG's a little sooner. It's actually been out since May 23rd this year, and they announced another odd flavor called Tiger's Blood starting just yesterday. And
okay.
I'm not quite sure what the ingredients are in EG's Tiger's Blood. I believe
that's not to ask.
I believe it's made with bits of real tiger, so it's got to be good.
No, great.
You know, on some other interesting news over here, you had the city council candidate Jesse Lugo on your show yesterday.
Yes, sir.
He's got a fundraiser this evening over at the Don Martini Bar on Congress, right, located right next to the Rialto, for those that are keeping score. If you'd like to meet candidate Jesse Lugo, I'm going to be over there as well, too, to say hi, to support him in his race. That particular city council race is going on August 5th, but ballots go out in just a very short period of time as well, too.
July 9th.
Which is why
one week from today.
Which is one of the other reasons that I'm really just vibing on July right now. Like, this is hot election month. Like, this is really serious political season going on over here right now, right? Ballots were mailed out now a couple of weeks ago in that congressional race. In fact, we'll know the answer in 2 weeks, who's going to win the Democrat and Republican primary for CD7. And we've had a lot of candidates from CD7 on this show over just the last month. Not shockingly, their presence lines up with when this election is. And we're going to know a lot about that in just 2 weeks. And the city council race for Ward 5 will be decided by August 5th because there's no Republican candidate running whatsoever.
Right.
So it is pretty much a mathematical certainty. Of course, barring some odd successful write-in campaign, I suppose mathematically this could occur. But given the politics of the city of Tucson, Matt, it's pretty safe to say that the winner on August 5th is going to be our city council.
Well, Sandra Cuomo comes in as a write-in candidate, you know, as he's wont to do in certain locations. So not to rain on your July parade, but we did go through the vacancy report for Pima County, and I think elections was probably 21% understaffed in the middle of an election, which, wow. And the recorder's office also is pretty highly understaffed.
Well, again, this is Tucson Ramadan. I send out an email once a week, right, to all of our guests that have chosen benevolently to share their email with us. And I choose to do it just once a week because you could imagine how annoying it would be if you heard from me every single day, right? And so we've got about 58,000 emails out there. And normally there's a certain percentage of just out-of-office responses. Well, when this email goes out this Friday, I'm expecting to see probably like a 20% out-of-office response, as, of course, Friday will be the 4th of July over here. And not shockingly, I bet you've got a lot of city employees taking long furloughs and leaves of absence in the month of July, which is one of the reasons that they've been so behind on this matching funds thing, right? That to my knowledge, no city council candidate has qualified yet, unless you've got some other inside information, as I've heard.
The council's taken How many meetings have they canceled this summer? I mean, even the electeds are taking time off. Lots.
Right, but this is one of the great things about the month of July. It's just easier to get things like this done. And of course, with rain on the forecast, possibly as soon as today, monsoon season happens to be my absolute favorite time of the entire year. You're kind of tired of June. It's hot as Hades in June. There is a 0% chance of monsoon. But when July rolls around, every day gives you the hope. When you see those towering cumulonimbus clouds forming to the northeast, you've got a little bit of hope. Even though it may not happen today, just even knowing there's a 10 or 15% chance of precipitation makes me happy, and I hope it makes you happy too. We're going to have a whopper of a show today, though. We've got the president of the National Border Council, Mr. Paul Perez, coming up at the half hour at 7:30. We've got Grover Norquist coming up at the 8:30 hour as well, too. The founder of Americans for Tax Reform. They're going to talk about some of the things that are going on right now federally and how that might affect us in Tucson. And when we come back after the break, we're going to talk about the first Proposition 312 lawsuit that has been filed as well, too. There is a start. It's not just monsoon season. It's about to start raining Prop 312 lawsuits on the city of Tucson. Don't go anywhere. You're listening to Grant Krueger on The Morning Voice, 10:30 a.m., your home for local news and talk. Welcome back to The Morning Voice. I am your host, Grant Krueger. And as we talked about at the top of the hour over here, it is about to start raining lawsuits on the city of Tucson. The first Proposition 3112 lawsuit was filed just a couple of weeks ago. For those that are keeping score at home, Proposition 3112 is the property tax rebate for non-enforcement of municipal nuisance laws bill that you, the voters, passed with 58% majority statewide last year. And this year in 2025 is the first time that people can file these lawsuits. So a Northwest Side homeowner has filed a $2,800 lawsuit talking about the general homelessness and nuisance areas that exist in the River and La Cholla area where their home happens to be located. This is going to be a really interesting barometer of Proposition 312 because I believe when this was crafted, the idea was that the rebate would essentially be your property taxes in your entirety, which for this homeowner is about $2,800 per year. However, there's a legal interpretation by city attorney Mike Rankin, who's still retiring in just a couple months over here too, by the way. But his legal opinion is that the city would actually only be responsible for the city portion of that money. And out of that $2,800, it's like $112. So are these Proposition 312 lawsuits going to be impactful to the city? A pile of $100 lawsuits isn't going to move the needle nearly as much as when business owners who pay incredible property taxes on their businesses, right? A location like something just like the Maverick, for example, could be a property tax of $16,000, $18,000, $20,000 a year. Much different than a homeowner's $3,000 or $4,000 or $5,000. Are we going to be able to file for the entire amount of our property taxes, or is it going to be essentially this 5% and really limit the impact of Proposition 312? I don't have the answer for that one, and I don't think anybody does yet, but the first lawsuit has been filed, and we're going to keep an eye out for that one. Our state government, of course, finally reached an accord on their particular budget. There had been a lot of brouhaha about that one, and those that pay attention to state politics are probably pretty well plugged into that one. But what I can tell you is that our current governor, Katie Hobbs, broke her own veto record. I believe there's now been 178 vetoes this year, shattering her 2023 record of 143
building
vetoes.
Building jobs in the pen industry, apparently.
Without a doubt. Like, I think that she's now had, she's eclipsed the previous veto record by nearly double in 2023 and has now beaten this one by another 15%. Ms. Hobbs has nearly 400 vetoes in her first 3 years in office. And so it's pretty interesting to see just how much of the work our state legislator does that just gets canceled out by the governor's pen. One of the things that I found to be most disturbing that was canceled out by the governor's pen this week was a bill that was out there to permanently ban red light cameras on a state level. If you remember, we had red light cameras in both unincorporated Pima County and in the city of Tucson. We had a contract with Red Flex Technologies and another contract with a company called American Traffic Systems. And both of those things really stunk. Not only were those companies found to have manipulated the times of the yellow lights on those cameras and shrinking them down to increase revenue, there wasn't a tremendous amount of statistics to suggest that these intersections, such as Tanque Verde and Kolb, were any safer than they were before. And as such, most consumers absolutely hate these laws. When they have an opportunity to go to the ballot, just like how minimum wage rules almost always, minimum wage ballot initiatives, I say almost always pass, traffic cameras almost always fail. There is nary a municipality in the universe, in the entire United States, whether it be local, state, or federal, that would vote for ticketed traffic cameras. And we had the opportunity to cement this into state law, and that was one of the 173 vetoes by Governor Hobbs. And there was also a plan to put that on the ballot as well, too, a backup plan. And that one failed as well, too, based on some minutiae and procedures. And so you're not going to get to vote on this one yet in 2025, but it may come up in 2026. I have a feeling we're going to end up seeing a statewide ballot initiative to potentially ban traffic cameras in perpetuity, and that is something that I am all for. As you see other municipalities in Phoenix, Tempe, for example, really taking advantage of their constituency and using this technology for financial gain. We've got the one big beautiful bill working its way through the federal government, right? The Senate passed that bill yesterday. It ended up at a 50-50 tie. And for those who got an A in high school civics class, right, the vice president gets to break that tie in the Senate. Correct. And so J.D. Vance gets to kind of step out of the limelight of being vice president and do something and take a Senate vote, which he did. And so that one has passed. It's now made its way to the House of Representatives. If they make any changes to it, it has to go back to the Senate and so on and so forth. We've got an internal deadline set to get this done by July 4th, and that's looking pretty nebulous right now. I mean, today is the 2nd of July, and there could be a lot of changes in this bill that could affect all of us locally. Certainly some positive and some negative. We're going to talk about the changes that this could have on the service industry at the top of the hour, the 8 o'clock hour, when we bring up food for thought and ways that some of these proposed changes could affect local restaurants and bars and our hospitality industry in general. But there are some other ones that I did find interesting up front. Looking at the solar energy credits, they could potentially go away. Those are the 48E credits that would essentially sunset in 2027. That's a 30% of the cost of putting together a solar system for your house. Now, this nationally probably doesn't have as big of impact. People from Michigan, like where I was born and raised, that solar's not going to do you very much good when you don't see the sun from like November to, let's call it March. You know, solar energy, not quite as important. But in Southern Arizona, these are things that could possibly pencil out for you, and only really penciled out if you had those credits. Having put solar on a home I owned before, there was about an nine year payout on this. And that was with these 30% tax credits. And so if they go away, you start looking at a 11, 12, 13-year payout on this one. Gosh, like you could just buy tax-free municipal bonds and almost get a better return.
Well, yeah, you start looking at your net present value of the savings, the cash up front versus the savings and the lifespan of the panels. And you'd really have to maybe be careful and do some good math.
DEP is obviously doing its part to try to help out the solar industry by still, suggesting to raise their rates for up to 14% this
right.
year. So
that maybe pushes a few people towards that.
Right. But nonetheless, this particular change, you know, might have an impact here on Southern Arizona, where solar is quite common. I see it in a number of my neighbors' houses. Sure. I've made that decision before in the past. That one, you know, could go either way when you see those particular credits in some capacity having a chance to go away. But I think there's going to be a lot of effects on this one big beautiful bill reverberating our way into Southern Arizona. And we've got some great guests coming up today. After the break, we're going to have Paul Perez. He's the president of the National Border Patrol Council, and he's going to talk about things going on at the border and how that affects us here in Southern Arizona. And I think there is absolutely no question that our proximity to Mexico affects our local economy and how all of these things tie together. And of course, we're going to have Grover Norquist, as we said, at the 8:30 hour. He is the founder and president of Americans for Tax Reform. He's going to call in and we're going to break down some of those effects of what they've got going on in Washington and how those things are going to change us here in Southern Arizona. Because we love to talk about all things local on 10:30 a.m. The Voice. We certainly have a lot of national news hitting right now, particularly when it is Ramadan week here in Tucson. So we're going to bring you a bit of national coverage and how this trickles down into Southern Arizona. I did want to say a big thank you to all of our listeners who showed up last week to the Casa del Rio Eat and Greet Mexican restaurant on the east side last Thursday. They had the opportunity to meet Matt and myself and Dr. Ackerley and many of the other hosts of The Morning Voice. There'll be other ones coming up this summer we'll announce, so please get out there if you want an opportunity to meet us and throw an enchilada or something at us and tell us we don't know what we're talking about in any capacity. Eat and greets are a great opportunity for you to do that. Don't go anywhere, though. We're going to have Paul Perez from the National Border Council coming up after the break.
If you'd like to follow along on Facebook, 1030 The Voice is the page, or on YouTube, 1030 The Voice is the page. We're streaming in video. Or you can listen on your trusty AM radio. But if you'd like to, you can watch us and see your voice, even in July. Morning Voice will be right back.
Welcome back to The Morning Voice. I am your host, Grant Kruger. So many birthdays here in this month. 249 years coming up for the United States. We just had the 101 anniversary from the United States Border Patrol. Actually had their 101st birthday from the National Origins Act in 1924 when that was passed in the creation of the Border Patrol. And to talk about that and all kinds of things happening with our border right now, we've got Mr. Paul Perez, president of the National Border Patrol Council, on the line in the KVOI studios. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning. It's great to be with you, and I appreciate you having us on. And yeah, it's been 101 years. I've been a part of it for 28 years, and I feel very fortunate to do the job.
Well, we're very fortunate, of course, to have you guys doing that job out there. As we've said before on this show, without borders, we don't really have a country anymore. How are things going for the border with you and your agents these days?
Well, it's night and day between what we had under the Biden administration and what we have under the Trump administration. We're actually able to go out there and do the job that we signed up to do. So it's a great feeling. It's a great time to be a Border Patrol agent. Our recruiting efforts are through the roof. We've got more applicants than we've ever had. And we've got Congress hopefully passing the big, beautiful bill to support our efforts to secure the border and bring operational control.
And you guys, as president of the National Border Patrol Council, you guys have been pretty big proponents of President Trump and this particular bill, no?
Yeah, we backed him during his first term. We backed him early on once he announced that he felt he was the only one. He was actually serious. And look where we're at now. He's actually followed through on all of his promises to secure the border, not only the border, but the country. And so we trusted in him then, and we trust in him now. He's never let us down.
How many agents make up the National Border Patrol Council, more or less?
16,500.
And is that number nationwide. Is that number up or down compared to previous years?
It's up. We have a very, very, we have the highest rate of membership in the entire country when it comes to law enforcement organizations. And so we're very proud of that. We do a good job. We've got good support from people like President Trump and others that allow us to get the resources that we need to do the job. So we're very, very outspoken on border security, and I think that's why people respect us.
And you just had the opportunity to go to the White House earlier last month, correct?
Yeah. It was a couple of weeks ago. I was able to go out there, and actually it was last week. I was able to go out there and speak on behalf of our agents for the big, beautiful bill. I'm a big proponent of it because what it does for border security is something that's never been done before. We're going to have more money to do everything that we've always wanted to do to secure the border and bring operational control, including building the wall and never having to go back to the Democrats and ask them for more money. It's something that they're vehemently opposed to. So that's good stuff for us in that bill.
Right. We ended up with a temporary border wall for a while in the state of Arizona because when the Biden administration came to power, Governor Ducey bought a number of storage containers, right, the Connex boxes, and essentially erected his own state wall only to have it taken down. And I believe a number of those boxes are still sitting at the state properties where the prison is located off of Wilmot Road to this day, just sort of rotting out there in the sun.
Yeah, that's the same thing that happened with the border wall that was purchased and paid for. It was just sitting there unfinished because on day one of Biden's administration, he put an end to the border wall construction. So it sat there for years. We actually took President Trump out there, and he was able to see it for himself. We took Vice President Vance as well, and they were both able to see what was completed. Now, with this money that we're going to get from the One Big Beautiful Bill, we're going to be able to control exactly where we put the wall. And the good thing about President Trump and his advisors is they always listen to the men and women on the front lines that tell them exactly where we need it and why. So we're going to build that wall. We're going to finish it up. It's going to be good.
Reports of the media are that border traffic, illegal crossings are down in record numbers. Can you give us a report from the field of what's actually going on over there as opposed to what the media is telling us?
Yeah, I can tell you the media on this is actually spot on. The numbers are the lowest that I've ever seen in my career, 28 years, and they're the lowest that we've ever had reported in Border Patrol history because, again, we have put all of our agents on the line, all of our agents that were pulled off the line to process and release the millions of people that Biden allowed in under his chaotic policies. We're able to put that manpower to actual good use in the field, on the line, and so we're able to deter, detect, and apprehend anybody that tries to cross. So when you hear that we released zero, that's actually legit. That's true. We're not releasing anybody compared to the, you know, thousands, tens of thousands we were doing a month and millions over the 4 years. So it's really, really different now because our agents are actually patrolling. We've got the military out there helping us. So it's a whole of government approach. We're holding the line while ICE and some of our agents go into the interior and get rid of the criminals that are in there.
So do you think that we're going to see a decreased amount of drugs on the street? In places like Tucson, Arizona, inexpensive fentanyl has made its way through our city, essentially just lobotomizing a section of the unhoused population to a level that we've never seen before. Our streets are overcrowded. Drugs are everywhere. The market price of a fentanyl pill, at least pre the Trump presidency, was said to be 50 cents. Like, how do you compete with 50 cents at that point? Like, what do you think these effects are going to have on the drug market here in southern Arizona?
Well, you know, a tighter border means that the cartels have to become more innovative. And look, the cartels had free reign during the 4 years that Biden was there. They had control, complete control of the southwest border on the Mexican side because our agents weren't able to be out there patrolling. Now that we've got the military, now we've got the assets, and we've got the other federal agencies actually able to go out there and track them now, it's going to be a lot harder for them to get their product in. And so we're able to now interdict a lot more of it. But these guys get crafty. They're not going to give up. So it's a great thing that President Trump designated the cartels as foreign terrorist organizations, because now we can go at the heart of the cartels to make sure that they don't bring their products like fentanyl into the United States. So we're getting a lot tougher on that. President Trump has given us the direction to make sure that we're able to interdict and apprehend any of the narcotics coming forward.
Without giving up too many trade secrets, how can you use technology in some way, shape, or form to catch these tiny little pills? Back in the day, 30 or 40 years ago, when people were smuggling marijuana into the country, it was large, voluminous, stinky, right? Dogs were able to sniff this sort of stuff out, and it took a lot of space. But now that it's so compact and so powerful, do you have like better tools than you did decades ago?
We do. We do have better tools. We've got better training, for our agents and our canine officers. And so, yeah, there are things that we're able to do now to combat the cartels because, again, the cartels have unlimited budgets. And, you know, there's a lot of corruption within the police forces in Mexico, within the military. And because of that, you know, they get the secrets. They get the trade secrets. They know how to do what it is they're doing to be successful. But our agents, our officers are out there, and we know better. So we're making sure that we put a dent. There's a lot of technology that we have that makes our job a lot easier.
Paul, I lived in Mexico for 11 years and had businesses down there as well, too. And we noticed that in a change of presidential administrations, there would often be a change in control of the military, which then translated to a change in which cartel was in power. The change of Mexican presidency happened in October of this year when Claudia Sheinbaum became president of Mexico, replacing López Obrador. Same political party, however. Has there been any change on the Mexican side? Is the Mexican government cooperating this time around with the Border Patrol?
Well, they're cooperating with the government to a degree because, again, President Trump brings the power of the United States into the White House. He sits behind the Resolute Desk in the Oval Office, and he commands the respect that we didn't have under President Biden, because President Trump means what he says, and when he dictates to these foreign leaders how he's going to operate and exactly what he needs them to do, they have a choice, because they know he's not just saying things to say them. He will follow through with whatever it is he says. So he's forcing the Mexican government, as well as other governments throughout the country, throughout the world, to actually participate, help us, because if they don't, we're going to do what we need to do, because he's going to end the cartel takeover of the southwest border on the Mexican side.
No, the cartels have always been controlling the shots down there in Mexico, even more so than the government, because they've infamously, of course, helped contribute to the government financially. And every time there was a change of power, there was political and social unrest, because the different cartels that were suddenly making their way up Highway 15, the game would change and you would be dealing with different parties sending product up. But it's a whole different world right now, Paul, now with fentanyl, because it's just not as easy to detect. It's so much smaller. You're not talking about semis filled with marijuana anymore.
Yeah, no, of course. You know, like I said earlier, the cartels, they get crafty. You know, they use drones. They use different methods of concealing it and trying to get it across. So they're not going to stop. And that's why it's important for us to do what we need to do to end their control of everything they have in Mexico. Like you said, they control everything. Through fear, through intimidation, through barbaric tactics that they utilize. And so the thing about the United States, President Trump, is we're not afraid to take the cartels on. And so we're going to go head on. I don't want to name them because I don't want to give them any clout. But the cartels are not only at war with the government, they're at war with each other as well. And so that weakens them. There's never going to be a day where the cartels are all on the same page, because money is the bottom line profit, and they all have access to the most lucrative corridors that are where they're able to bring their products and goods over. But we're doing everything we can, everything that President Trump will allow us to do, to put a dent and stop it once and for all.
I love it. Hey, Paul, you got time to take a quick break with me over here? We're listening to Paul Perez, president of the National Border Patrol Council. Can you stick around for one more segment with me, Paul?
Yep, absolutely.
Right, we're going to take a quick break. Don't go anywhere. You're listening to Grant Krueger and Paul Perez on 1030 AM The Voice, your home for local news and talk. Welcome back to The Morning Voice. I'm your host, Grant Krueger. We've got another segment with Paul Perez. He's the president of the National Border Patrol Council. Welcome back, Paul.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Hey, thanks for spending part of your Wednesday morning with us and breaking down what's really happening out there on the border. Of course, as we all know on national news, Paul, like, this bill is working its way back to the House of Representatives over there. And I've heard some people say, some local media say, that the border package isn't really necessary because President Trump has already secured the border over there. Can you break down some of the improvements that would come to the Border Patrol in this particular bill?
Sure. We're going to get the funding for the wall, to complete the wall where we need it. The wall that President Biden stopped building once he took over, that should have been done. And so there's going to be money for that, to make sure that we don't have to go back to Congress and get the Democrats to put any stops to it. We're going to, our fleet is in disarray, and our fleet's in disarray because under the Biden administration, they paid no attention to it. They didn't give us the funding that we needed. So we're going to buy new vehicles, thousands of new vehicles. We're going to get the technology that we need. We're going to get autonomous towers. We're going to get more towers where we can see. We're going to get night vision equipment. We're going to get a lot of technology, drones, that is going to help us actually do the job a lot better, because under the Biden administration, we weren't getting what we needed. They were spending all of the money that they had on housing, facilitating the entry, and bringing people in through the CBP One app. So that's where all our money was going. So now under the Trump administration, we're actually going to have the money, the technology that we need to get everything. We're going to be able to retain and recruit more agents. You know, we're going to get about 3,000 more agents under this bill, which will allow us to decrease some of the military personnel that we have on the border. But depending on how the cartels react to all of our to our posture, to our new posture in the line, we may keep some of the military and their assets out there as well a little bit longer. But what we're trying to do is make sure that this border is the most secure border ever, and it stays that way. So that's why we need the money that's in the big, beautiful bill.
So many people mistake border security with an immigration process, too, and lump them all together in one sort of thing. They say, well, if you build a wall, if you build a strong border, you're somehow anti-immigrant. Can you help me break down the difference between those two things for our listeners so that they can understand?
Sure, yeah. We've been a very generous country when it comes to allowing legal immigration, and that's the key, legal immigration. So people put their paperwork in, people that come into the country legally, they're interviewed, and we make sure that these people coming in are not going to become public charges. It's not going to be somebody that's going to come in and be unproductive members of society. These people are going to come in, they're either going to visit, or they're going to come and become legal permanent residents. They're going to work, they're going to pay taxes, they're going to be productive citizens, and we're not going to have to deal with them. The illegal immigration aspect of it is the people that are coming in that shouldn't be here, because they know that if they get apprehended, they have criminal records, they're going to be deported, they're going to be sent to prison. So again, we've always allowed people with technology degrees, you know, people that have come in and actually been productive to our country. It is the greatest country in the world, and we've always allowed people in, but what we don't want is illegal immigration.
Without a doubt, there's a proper way to go through that process. And as I told you, Paul, like, I lived in Mexico. I had to go through an immigration process that was incredibly rigorous, incredibly difficult, and incredibly expensive to get my working papers down there. But I did it the right way, because that's what you're supposed to do. It shouldn't be that terribly difficult for people to have access to this information, especially with the internet these days, that how these procedures and processes work. The United States, to me, has always been open to immigrants, just to people that do it the right way.
Yes, it has been. And there are countries that portray themselves as a lot tougher than the United States on immigration. And, you know, Mexico is one of those countries where you just said, you go down there and you've got to jump through hoops to get a working permit. But yet we've got people that come from Mexico illegally that are entitled, that want everything handed to them. And that's just not the way our country was built. That's not how a country should handle things.
Without a doubt. We've only got a couple more minutes here left in this segment, Paul, but I wanted to ask you quickly, any knowledge of local immigration raids happening to businesses? On social media locally, you see businesses posting signs, ICE officials must show a warrant, you can't do these sort of actions in our establishments. And yet, as somebody that locally deals with a lot of business owners, I'm not hearing about any of these supposed raids that the media is talking about. Is this really occurring, and particularly in businesses right now?
So what I can tell you is ICE is operating around the clock, around the country, and they're doing what is termed targeted raids. They're not just going randomly. They're making sure that they're following the president's orders, which is get these criminals out. And if people happen to be rounded up that are illegally, we're not going to turn a blind eye. So a lot of the protest, a lot of the craziness that you see from these rioters and everything was because they were there misinforming everybody about what was going on, exactly what you're talking about. So when they're hitting places, when ICE is going out and doing these quote raids, this is a targeted operation. They're going after people specifically that they know are there or should be there, and they're going after them. But again, if there happens to be somebody that's illegal, they're going to be taken in as well, because we're not going to look the other way.
Well, we appreciate here in Southern Arizona the job that you guys are doing here, protecting our border and helping keep our streets safe from drugs, because we've had a tremendous, tremendous problem over here over the last 4 years. And so we just can't thank you guys enough for going out and being that difference and keeping us all safe on the streets of Southern Arizona. Thank you, Paul, for spending part of your Wednesday morning with us.
Yeah, absolutely. I love Southern Arizona.
Thanks. We love you guys as well, too. This has been Paul Perez, president of the National Border Patrol Council. God bless you and your 16,500 agents that are out there keeping all of us a little bit safer on the streets. Don't go anywhere. We've got another hour of The Morning Voice coming up on 10:30 a.m., your home for local news and talk.
The Morning Voice rolls on. We'll be right back after the news. We'll be talking to Grover Norquist in the 8 o'clock hour.
Welcome back to Hour 2 of The Morning Voice. Every weekday, 7 to 9 a.m., you get The Morning Voice. Five different faces, five different voices on things that are happening here in Southern Arizona. On Mondays, you've got Lydia Aranda. On Tuesdays, Ted Maxwell from the SALC, bringing his engagement hour. A lot of local politicians there. On Wednesdays, you get me, Food for Thought. Little local infusion of restaurants, politics, and business news. On Thursdays, Tom Moulton from the Southern Arizona Attractions Alliance, and on Fridays, Dr. Ed Ackerley from the University of Arizona. Matt Neely's been filling in quite a bit, did a great job on the show yesterday if you didn't get a chance to listen to him and City Council candidate Jesse Lugo. Matt should get some more opportunities here on The Morning Voice. Maybe we should go to 7 days.
Thank you very much, Grant. We had a good time. We talked to Jesse Lugo, and then we talked to author Ann Hillerman about taking over, following in the huge footsteps that her father left before he unfortunately passed away several years ago. But it was a really fun discussion, and we even talked about Dark Winds, which she is part of as an executive producer. So that's all up. Podcast is up. You can watch the video of it. The Grover was on at 7:30, so he's about 30 minutes into the video, and then Ann was on at 8 o'clock. So we had a great time, and thanks for the kind words.
Of course. Great job over there, Matt. So again, at the first hour, we talked about July and my love for July, right? It is the time for me to relax a little bit, roll up my sleeves, you know, enjoy the fruits of our labor. We generally lose a lot of money operating in the summer months in Tucson in July. It's just the nature of the beast, right? This is cash flow management. You've got to squirrel away your nuts for the summer. But every year when the 4th of July comes up, this big question about whether we should open or not our establishments on the 4th. Because the 4th doesn't fall on the same day of the week every year, it actually has a different effect than, say, something like Thanksgiving that always hits on a Thursday. And as such, you've really got to think about it. If the 4th of July hits on a Monday or Tuesday, well, it's already kind of like the death touch to a day. You normally will get about a 50% sales drop compared to your regular day on the 4th of July. I've got 35 years of industry experience. You've having
got
watched
a few data points there, huh?
Yes, watching enough 4th of Julys roll through. But when it hits on a Friday or Saturday, you got to kind of think about it, because 50% of a Friday or Saturday can still be better than a Monday or Tuesday or Wednesday.
Correct.
In the restaurant business. And so if and when and how you close become a major topic of conversation. And of course, you can't make everybody happy. If I could close for every holiday and give my staff off to spend and celebrate with their families, gosh, I'd love to. But then suddenly, what would that do to my guests? What if I'd have said, you know what? I'm not going to open on Valentine's Day because it's a holiday, and that way my staff can spend it with their sweethearts. Or if I said, I'm not opening on Mother's Day because I hire a lot of mothers, and that way they can go spend it with their children or with their mothers. There comes a point where we have to serve people no matter what. And when these holidays come up on a Friday or Saturday, you're likely to see a number of establishments in Tucson make that decision to stay open. So do go out there and support them. I know it's a big barbecue day. I know it's a big, you know, backyard party sort of day. We all get together and have an adult beverage or two, grill up a burger, watch a mountain burn down to the ground. I think that's going to happen 7 to 9.
I think we're going to get pre-soaked today and tomorrow. So I think maybe not. Maybe it won't burn down this year.
Right. Honestly,
we can always hope, Grant.
This is not, I'm not rooting, of course, for the incendiary properties of A Mountain, but I've been around enough to see this happen on more than five
occasions. This ain't our
first
rodeo.
Yes, very truly. And so it is something to be concerned about for sure, because, you know, it's pretty dry in the desert and we haven't had an awful lot of rain. And so I'm really excited for these next couple days. And I always do get excited about July. Now, not a whole lot happens, of course, in July. In the restaurant business, as you could imagine. There are some news popping up, though. I've got a few pieces for you guys here today. Starting, it looks like the Black Iris Cafe has announced their closure. This was an ill-fated restaurant that lasted just over a year in a location on 4th Avenue, on the east side of the avenue, that had previously housed Blush. And then before that, it was a donut concept. And before that, it was a concept called U.S.
Fries. Oh, the Hawaiian donut place.
Yes.
I remember that, yeah.
Yep. And so, unfortunately, unfortunately, this location continues its difficult economic spiral and probably does fit in that category of locations that people would call quote-unquote cursed, right? Mm. You're looking at a near annual turnover in this particular spot, and the challenges continue on 4th Avenue. I walked the space just the other day that was Hermano's, right? It's up for lease. And out of morbid curiosity and an idea of what's on the market out there, we went to take a look at that space. And it was a cool, neat little build out that they did for that one with that portal cocktail lounge in the back. And it's still available to this day. It's been available since February, since they announced their closure. And now the Black Iris, just down the street, same side of the street of 4th Avenue, has lamentably announced that they have closed as well, too, with a notice on their Facebook page last Thursday. There does appear to be a new owner of the Outlaw Bar and Grill. As someone that was hanging around the Board of Supervisors meeting yesterday and watching that sort of thing, I tend to pay attention to the liquor licenses, approvals, and disapprovals. This is sort of how I get a bit of my gossip on the know. You know, if you want to figure these things out, like there are certain tells about what's coming and what's not. And because there's a legal processes behind liquor licenses, as you can imagine, you just don't want anybody and their brother getting one. It requires a both municipal and state approval process. And so that has been filed for the Outlaw. So there's a new owner coming on the books for that bar that's located at 1302 West Roger Road. The Outlaw's had a number of owners over the last 3 years, 4 years as well, too. Quite a few changes. As somebody that runs a country bar in Tucson, too, I can tell you it's no easy feat, right? Live music is an awesome, awesome tool, and all the guests love it. But it also continues to get more expensive. And it's difficult to pay for live music through just food and beverage sales. Is there enough margin to pay for a $1,000 band on Friday and Saturday? You got five guys in a band. They all want to make a couple hundred bucks for working on a weekend. Mm-hmm. You're into it for a grand. Oh, you want a sound engineer as well too? Well, great. There's another couple hundred bucks. So you just can't do an extra $1,000 in sales to make the live music work. You got to do $1,000 to $1,200 in margin, which might be many thousands in sales. And as such, live music operations, particularly on the smaller side of things, tend to struggle a bit because it's hard for them to monetize the cost of that live music. Unless, of course, they put up a cover charge, which basically would be just to pay for the band, but it's always met with a bit of ire from the guests who don't want to pay just to walk in the front door.
Sure.
And so it creates some issues. And so there happens to be a new owner of the Outlaw Bar and Grill. On a more positive news, Penelope Pizza was named by a national source as the number 42 pizza restaurant in the United States out of 50.
Good for them.
They're a alumnus now of the Morning Voice, right? Jared Swartz, that owner, both has been on this radio show with me, and he used to work for me over at Reforma as well, too. I remember when he was just starting out with his pizza truck concept as well, too. And we actually talked quite a bit about opening our own business and those challenges. And so I love having some of our former students, our former team members go out and create their own places and to see that success. Like, I couldn't get more proud than to see people underneath me rise up and create their own businesses.
A little bit of family tree there.
Very restaurant. Much.
Yeah, that's neat.
Very much so. And so we're really proud of Jared Swartz for getting that award for Penelope Pizza on the East Side.
And you used the phrase cursed location, and that was sort of turning into a cursed location. It had been a number of things over 20 years, and including vacant, a thing called vacant, as you'd like to say. And I think he broke the curse, man. And they're doing a great job over there. So good for them.
Which is great to see. And curses can, in fact, be broken, right?
Amen.
Maybe, you know, we got pretty lucky in the Proof location in St. Phil's Plaza, not to toot our own horn or talk too much about our own restaurants, but it also had a similar fate. It had been five different restaurants, Matt, in 5 years. All of them had failed inside of a year. And so when we said, hey, we're going to take over this cursed location and put a restaurant concept in, people went, oh my God, you should absolutely not touch that thing. You know, with a 10-foot pole, like, that location is cursed. It is never, ever going to make it. It has this defect and that defect and this thing's wrong with it. And here we are about to celebrate our 7th anniversary of Proof Restaurant, still in business. And we also beat the curse with good pizza. I wonder if there's a correlation between that one. Maybe these curses can just be beat by good pizza, such as Penelope Pizza over here beating the curse. Proof comes in. I like to think it's good pizza as well, too. Maybe good pizza
Grant
is
Kruger
the curse
connecting
slayer.
The dots. I like this.
Just saying, like, maybe there's a correlation between good pizza and beating curses. I'm all for more great restaurants.
It's because lots of pizzas have garlic in them. And that's it. It's the garlic.
It must be, or some sort of sage, right? The exorcism, getting the demons out of some of these cursed locations over here. But either way, we're really proud of Jared on the Morning Voice over here. That's an awesome little award there, a little gold star for an upstart Tucson restaurant that did go into a really challenged location and is absolutely crushing it. I couldn't be more excited for them. As well, too, on 22nd Street, Perla del Pacifico announced their reopening. They had been closed for a number of months and remodeled. It's on the 5,000 block of 22nd. I haven't had a chance to check this one out yet, but I think a Mexican Mariscos place.
The old Mama Sanchez place on the north side of the street, maybe?
Yes.
Yeah,
That establishment just reopened on the 26th of June. They announced on their social media as well, too. So we do have a couple places popping up, even in Tucson Ramadan in the summer, and that's always neat to see. So get out there and support those local restaurants because they need your help in July more than ever. Buy gift cards, go out there, spend good money, tip well, enjoy the local establishments. Your jeans, they're going to be there. There's going to be time for the Texas Roadhouse or the Olive Garden or the Outback. They're going to be just fine. But when you think of these other little locations, particularly if it's got some sort of reputation as being cursed, get out there and support those local restaurants. Let's take another quick break. We're going to have Grover Norquist coming up at the half hour. We've got lots of great other local news. I'm going to break down this big, beautiful bill and how some of these provisions are going to affect local restaurants and hospitality when we come back after the break.
And if you'd like to watch as well as listen, you can follow along on 1030 The Voice Facebook page. 1030 The Voice. Hit that like and follow button too. You can also watch on YouTube if you'd like to do that. Again, the name of that page is 1030 The Voice as well. We'll see you there.
Welcome back to The Morning Voice. Thank you for spending part of your Wednesday morning with us. I love local business and talking all things that affect us and the ways that this affects the service industry in Southern Arizona and the state as a whole. One thing that's going to change at the beginning of the calendar year is cocktails to go. Cocktails to go have been legal in the state of Arizona since October of 2021, since the passing of House Bill 2773. And quite frankly, it hasn't really caught on yet. Just in the last couple of weeks, Nevada State Governor Joe Lombardo made Nevada the 31st U.S. state to legalize cocktails to go. I thought cocktails were always free to go in Nevada and Las Vegas over there. I think I might have violated a state rule once or twice in my youth. Hopefully the statutes of limitations have passed on these violations. But now 31 U.S. states are doing this. Cocktails to go have been legal in the state of Arizona, but only under an odd lease provision. For a restaurant to sell cocktails to go, I actually had to find a bar liquor license and lease their to-go privileges from them. And as such, it created a weird connection of sort of tinder between bar owners that no longer wanted to use their to-go privileges and restaurants that wanted to meet them together. And starting on January 1st of 2026, we're going to have the ability to just apply to the state directly for cocktails to go. And I'm hoping that they lighten up a little bit of these rules as well, too. In a world where you can now actively smoke fentanyl at the bus stop and nobody seems to care, right? I'm not as worried about public alcohol consumption as a scourge as we might have been in, say, the 1920s.
You raise a good point.
Right? Like, at what point does it become ridiculous that I've got to fight a customer to take a beer to go? And I've literally come to fisticuffs with guests before over them trying to leave the establishment.
Probably not after their first beer either.
I can neither confirm nor deny the accuracy of that statement. However, it happens quite a bit that we end up in terrible altercations with guests who are attempting to take something to go, particularly in a large, porous establishment like we have in St. Philip's Plaza, where there's a lot of ingresses and egresses, and this can become a real problem. And yet, harder drugs are just all over on the streets. And so this cocktails to go problem really lies with the packaging. Most restaurants don't have some sort of boba tea sealer or canning machine or something along these lines to meet the sealing requirements. During COVID, we took the opportunity to sell you a cocktail to go with a straw lid and a piece of tape over the top. And maybe some people went to this sealed plastic boba lid and then handed you a spiky straw and said, okay, here's your sealed cocktail. And it's separate from this spiky straw that I'm also handing
wink,
you.
Wink, wink.
Yeah, if you combine those two together, you've broken the law. Please don't do this. I can only hand you these two things. And I feel like we've got to make some changes on that one to make this make sense and be competitive for local restaurants to take advantage of this. As well, there are other laws coming up on the books federally as part of this one big, beautiful bill that's looking for House approval right now. And those of us in the service industry have really been paying an awful lot of attention as what's going on in this one big, beautiful bill for two purposes. One is that no tax on tips declaration, right? This was a campaign promise by President Trump. It was also a campaign promise by candidate Harris. And those of us in the service industry really worried that the implementation of that, depending on which candidate won, was going to be problematic. I could have seen the Harris campaign winning and saying, no tax on tips for the employee, but here it is for the business, you get double. And certainly, there was going to need to be some guardrails on this one, no matter who made this campaign promise. What defines a tip? At what point could I go out and say, hey, landscaper guy, thanks for clearing my hedges. Here's $10 in payment, and here's $1,000 for a tip. Hey, legal attorney, I really appreciate your help in this court case with me. Here's $1,000 in payment and a $10,000 tip. Clearly, there has to be some sort of limitations on this. And I give kudos to our federal government for working and putting these guardrails in this one big, beautiful bill. Right now, as it stands, and of course, these are subject to potential House changes, but I don't see the no tax on tips thing moving. It hasn't been part of what's been flip-flopping back and forth here. There's going to be a limit on $25,000 total in tips that will be no tax, and that's federal no tax. That doesn't mean you're not paying state taxes still and that you're not paying into FICA and Social Security in some capacity. This is just the federal line item. So it's limited to $25,000, limited to the service industry, and there's a cap on total earnings of $160,000 as well. And so I'm really excited to see these caps put on this one so that there are some guardrails in place for this. It will probably break down to an additional $1,500 or so in tax savings to your average server or bartender in Tucson. As someone that does the payroll for hundreds of employees, I can tell you that this is going to be impactful. As well, they've cleared up the definition about whether this was cash tips or not. There was a lot of confusion that for a while credit card tips may not actually qualify for this, that it was only cash tips. And so the word cash had to be more clearly defined. And in these revisions, they've cleaned that one up. And so we're pretty excited about it. And the second one that we're excited about coming for our staff members in the service industry is no tax on overtime. We've for years struggled with overtime because a lot of staff members that work in the service industry, particularly in the back of house, would actually love to work more hours. Like there's a lot of people that by virtue of making 17, 18, 19, 20 bucks an hour in the back of house, not participating in a qualified tip pool, would actually love to work 50 hours a week. The problem is the establishments can't just afford to pay everybody time and a half for overtime. And in fact, we've created with the Affordable Health Care Act, we've created this incentive for businesses to only employ you 29.99 hours per week on average to not be an FTE, full-time employee equivalent. And we don't follow this practice in my restaurant, in full disclosure, but it's quite common in the industry. And if you're really paying attention to the finances, it unfortunately makes financial sense. We've got this negative incentive created by the Affordable Health Care Act for me to employ you exactly 29.99 hours or less. So then what do you do as a staff member? You have to go get a second job. And then you end up working two jobs at 24.99 or 29.99 hours each, both of which aren't giving you full-time benefits. And then you've got to travel in between these two places. And you may or may not have an automobile of you know, working caliber. This sort of travel between these two jobs create conflict. Even the idea that you might both get scheduled at the same day. There's a very inequitable distribution between when restaurants are busy and when they're not. And so everyone's going to want you to work Friday and Saturday night. You got two jobs. They both schedule you for Friday because it's a blind drop. They don't see the other restaurant scheduling, and you end up with a lot of conflict. This happens everywhere in my industry. And the whole problem, quite frankly, is our federal overtime laws forcing this time and a half, and then our federal laws with respect to the Affordable Health Care Act causing this situation where many, many of my back of house employees have two jobs, whether I like it or not. And so the one big beautiful bill not taxing overtime will be helpful to make those overtime earnings more impactful to restaurants. I would hope that at some point we look federally to actually change that number of overtime and look at and say, you know what, 40 hours a week isn't that extreme. I often do 40 hours a week between, let's say, Monday and Tuesday or Monday and Wednesday in my industry, and not knocking anybody in an office or government job that has a lot more paid holidays off than the restaurant business. There's a lot of people out there in the United States who would gladly work 45 or 48 hours a week to help feed their family or be that sole breadwinner for their entire family. And so the entirety of overtime laws need to be looked at. We're excited for the One Big Beautiful Bill to not have taxes on overtime for those hourly employees. It's not the fix to this problem that I just told you about, but it's absolutely a start that I am super excited for. And I think a lot of our employees are excited for as well too. I've been getting hit up over just the last few weeks by an awful lot of servers and bartenders when they get their paycheck and they say, hey boss, there's still taxes on here. When is it coming? Hey boss, there's still taxes. And I say, guys, this is the process. It's gonna take a little bit of time. Relax, it's coming, and it looks like the cavalry is right around the corner. As soon as July 4th, this may become law. And when we come back after our break, we're going to bring on Grover Norquist, a man that knows a thing or two about taxation in the United States. We're going to talk about what's coming up in that One Big Beautiful Bill, both nationally and how it's going to affect you here in the Old Pueblo. This is a segment you're not going to miss. Don't go anywhere. You're listening to Grant Krueger on The Morning Voice, 10:30 a.m. You're home for local news and talk.
We're streaming on Facebook and YouTube. Go to 1030 The Voice on Facebook or YouTube, the name of our page on both platforms. You can see your voice even in this hot, sweltering July weather.
Welcome back to The Morning Voice. I am your host, Grant Krueger. And with this One Big Beautiful Bill coming up, there is so much information out there, so much noise. It's hard to disseminate what's happening and what makes sense for you here in Southern Arizona. And so we are lucky to have a guest on the radio station with us this morning who happened to be the founder and president of Americans for Tax Reform, an economist, a Harvard-educated MBA, Mr. Grover Norquist. Good morning, Grover.
Hey, good morning. Good to be with you.
Hey, thanks so much for spending part of your Wednesday with us over here. So much national news is going on right now about this One Big Beautiful Bill. You're the founder of the Taxpayer Protection Pledge. You have absolutely been involved with every single conservative presidential campaign going back to probably the Nixon campaign, right? Since the late 60s. What's your take on this one?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
What's your take on this One Big Beautiful Bill coming up before America's birthday on Friday?
It is an extremely important piece of legislation. It defines the Trump administration. It has in it spending restraint on entitlements, beginning to think through how we can slow the growth of entitlements and make sure that they don't bankrupt the country, both Medicaid, requiring that people, able-bodied people old enough to work, need to either be working or actively work, looking for work, which is the law, but that's not what Obama did. People need to be citizens. People on food stamps also need to be able-bodied people need to be working. Too many people have been handed government checks because the Democrats are buying friends at the expense of the American people who are paying for this all. So some spending restraint. Have we solved all the overspending? No, we have almost 100 years of vast overspending that crept up on us and is overwhelming us. It's going to take us more than a few weeks to get rid of it or to even get our hands around it. But also serious tax reduction. And I don't mean tax cuts that will be repealed in 2 years or that disappear in 5 years, because we've had those in the past. The rules make it very difficult to have permanent tax reduction. And this time around, that's what we got. We got permanent tax reduction. Everybody got lower rates from the Trump tax cut.
however much money you make, if you're a taxpayer, your tax rate was reduced thanks to the Republican tax cut of 2017. Those lower taxes were scheduled to go back to Obama levels of taxes within 7 months.
No, we were very concerned about that in the small business world. You know, 199A, qualified business income, and like full depreciation were all things set to expire. That would be incredibly negatively impactful on local small businesses.
And in the past, what we sometimes thought was the best we could do would be to kick the can down the road 5 years, extended 5 years, or even 10, which means 5 years from now, you have the same panic. And businessmen and women deciding, should I hire another five people? Should I buy a bigger truck? Should I get people upgrades on the computers? Whatever it is to make their workers more effective and efficient and productive so that they can get paid more, can produce more and get paid more. You can't make those decisions if you don't know what the tax policy is 5 years, 10 years, 20 years from now. So these are now permanent. Now, the House still has to vote for it. And there are a handful of people wandering around whining, going, oh, it's not perfect. You know what? It's not perfect. It is a tremendous step forward. And if we don't take this step forward, those giant steps forward that somebody in their own mind, which I have things that I really would like to see, big tax cuts yet to be done. But my imaginary tax cuts of the future and congressmen's imaginary tax cuts of the future, imaginary now, we hope to make them real, they become more likely if we take this significant step forward and make this bill pass. If this doesn't happen, not only do taxes go up somewhere between $4 and $5 trillion over the next decade, but the chances of getting a tax cut in the future go way, way down. So I have very little sympathy for people who at this point are doing anything other than, could I ask the president and the Republican leadership, House and Senate, to consider these additional, this is what I'm doing. I'm going to the leadership and saying, here's some tax cuts we didn't get this time around, but I think would make sense in the future, and start to build popular support for those tax reductions and those spending reductions for the next, it's going to be another bill in November, you know, and one in the spring in January, February, March. There are two more buses leaving the station. Anybody who's panicked because their favorite cousin wasn't on this bus needs to know that he'll catch up with us. We'll get him on the next bus. This is such an important project. We got permanent tax relief on expensing for new business investment, lower taxes for small businesses, an amazing progress, no taxes on tips. These are very good steps, doubling the personal per child tax deduction, doubling the standard deduction. All of this disappears if we don't pass this bill. So, and the Senate passed a bill which improved a lot of the House, but also didn't have some of the things the House wanted. But they did that in cooperation with House members and particularly with President Trump. So these were all thought through. There are no surprises here. But some people in the House might go, well, maybe we could make these little changes here and then we send it back to the Senate and our progress would be added to their progress. Well, here's what happened on that one. Murkowski, lady senator from Alaska, who's unfortunately a big spender, she's announced, I want you guys to send it back because there's more stuff I want to stick in the bill here. So she announced, if you in the House don't pass this and you send it back, I'm going to make it worse from the standpoint of taxpayers, worse from the standpoint of people who are concerned about overspending by government. We can't send it back to the Senate. It passed 50-50. She was one of our votes. You send it back to that Senate, it doesn't get better. It gets worse. And you know, I think that's obvious, but she went and told us out loud. So you don't have to guess what it would look like. So that's why this is going to happen. I think the president's sitting down with anyone who has questions and say, you got good tax cuts, you got good spending cuts. I'm for them all. They're not going to fit in this bill, but we got two more bills coming up.
as a conservative, right, and probably one of the staunchest conservatives out there, quite frankly, Glover, like, you worked on Ronald Reagan's campaign, and he said no government ever voluntarily reduces itself in size. A government bureau is the nearest thing to eternal life we will ever see on this earth. Would Ronald Reagan approve of this bill?
Oh, yes, because it builds on what he accomplished. Reagan got the personal income taxes down 25% in the first tax cut, and that gave us 7 years of strong growth, and he took the corporate rate down to 50%. It was worse than that. But then in his last bill, he got the corporate rate to 34 and the individual rate to 27 and 15. Now, it got a little worse thanks to Mr. Bush, who gave a tax increase to the other team, and that made us walk backwards. But what Trump did was he cut the corporate rate from 35, highest in the world, worse than France, worse than China, and he took that down. He did with the corporate rate what Reagan did with the individual rate, which is to take it down and give us tremendous growth. You know, we're raising more money on the corporate tax today than when it was 30, now that it's a 21% rate, up from when it was a 35% rate. Why? More companies, more jobs, more created wealth. A tax cut, rates lower, but the government's actually getting more money because the companies are more productive and more successful, which is what Reagan did with the lower marginal rates on individuals. So, Trump stands on Reagan's shoulders, and Reagan would applaud Trump's additional successes amazingly.
Do you think that the upcoming tariffs, as we start to work our way into tariffs, affect this one as well, too? You, and of course, your taxpayer protection pledge had talked about not having an increase in taxes ever if there's not a reciprocal decrease. Are tariffs an increased tax? And is there or should there be a reciprocal decrease because of the tariffs?
Well, it is true. Tariffs are taxes. They're taxes at the border. And they're paid by Americans. They're not paid by foreigners. American tariffs are paid by Americans. Chinese tariffs are paid by Chinese people. What the president has said that he's doing, and what we've seen some real successes on in the negotiation with Canada, he insisted that they get rid of this vicious tax that they put on American successful high-tech companies. And it's just a looting tax on all the companies have been so successful, and they want to get the money. So, and they don't tax their own people, just the Americans. The Canadians agreed to remove that tax. The Europeans have a similar tax. And we had a tax that the Republicans and Trump were threatening to put into this bill to punish Europe for having these taxes on American electronic businesses. And the Europeans said, okay, we give up. We're going to get rid of those taxes. And so we're not putting the punishing tax into this bill. So the president's, you know, you worry when you start a trade war that you get stuck with trade tariffs rather than get rid of trade tariffs. The president's had very real success in reducing trade tariffs by our people that we compete with in the world. Yes.
That's awesome, Grover. Thank you for that analysis. This is Grover Norquist. Grover, do you've got time to take a quick break with me over here? We've got to cut to a commercial break. Can you stick around for one more segment?
I can't right now because I'm just walking into a TV show here and they want to put makeup on me. But I'd love to get together later in the week or next week.
Yeah, we'd love to have you more on The Morning Voice. Anytime. The doors and microphone are always open for you over here, sir.
Okie dokie. Thanks so very much.
Thank you so much for joining us on The Morning Voice. Grover Norquist, noted conservative, it's an amazing opportunity to have you over here. Thank you for spending part of your Wednesday morning with us.
Thank you.
Don't go anywhere. We've got one more segment of The Morning Voice coming up right after the break. Welcome back to the final segment of The Morning Voice. I'm your host, Grant Kruger. What an amazing guy over there, Grover Norquist, huh? So such a treat to have a guy like that on our show over here.
It was great. And, you know, I had thought about doing the argument, counter-argument thing with him because, you know, we've all heard a lot of things. And he came right out of the gate with one of them. We got the governor, Governor Hobbs, saying that, quote, hundreds of thousands of Medicare recipients are going to lose their coverage because of this. And he reiterated the point that they're just looking for more frequent checks to see if they're working, more frequent verification checks. So, you know, I think, you know, we're getting, obviously we're getting, either side is going to give rhetoric, right? So, I mean, that's politics. But, you know, you've got Senator, the governor, taking away people's health care so that, quote, billionaires can have more tax cut. We got Senator Mark Kelly. I like this one. This bill gives another tax break to the ultra wealthy so they can buy another private jet. So I guess if that's the deal, Grant, you and I ought to go long on Gulfstream futures.
I've been shopping for G5s already, as you could tell, in the restaurant business, just making it happen for us over here.
That's right. And then we had a pundit on this station yesterday in the noon hour saying that the tariffs are going to cause a major recession in the third quarter. Started throwing around words like stagflation and price increases without wage increases. So, you know, the other side's giving it to you full barrel. So it's good that you have Grover Norquist on talking about what the intent of all these things is and what the reason they're doing extending tax cuts on everybody, not, you know, just.
And the tax cuts on Social Security, I think, are something that we really need to look at favorably here in Tucson, particularly with an older demographic that live here, that dine here in our establishments, that go out and spend money. If you've got less taxes on your Social Security money or no taxes on it, you've got more disposable income. It's one of the things that we've argued so much about with the sales taxes, as the city of Tucson tried, of course, infamously earlier this year to raise sales tax, that this is a tax that is unavoidable. This sort of inflation hurts seniors. The rising cost of goods sold hurts everybody on a fixed income in some capacity and makes things worse for just about everybody. And so I think there's a lot of provisions in this that are going to be helpful, not just nationally, but reverberate here to Southern Arizona as well, too. And I really found the first hour to be pretty fascinating with Paul Perez from the Border Patrol to talk about just how much they've really got things shut down over there. Like, I wonder if they've truly shut down the drug market, or at least the portion you're going to catch, because I think everybody can clearly articulate that you're never going to get 100%. But if you reduce this even by half or more, are you in fact, you know, reducing the supply to a level that's going to actually increase the prices on the street, making it a less desirable drug in some capacity? And I think we've got a caller on the line over here, Matt, Mr. Charles Heller. Good morning, Charles.
Good morning. You know, I want to point out something about economics. And when people make a comment like Governor Hobbit did, that the losing Medicare so that billionaires can have more, or, you know, can buy jets, whoever said that, what they don't understand is who benefits economically when someone buys a G5.
Yeah, firearms expert Mark Kelly said that, Charles.
Yeah. Wait, I get
your punchline.
But the point is,
I know where you're going. That creates jobs, does it not?
It not only jobs, but there's secondary, and to create a word, thirdary effect that happen within the economy.
Tertiary is what you're reaching for there, buddy.
That's it. You're right. Thank you. But I stand corrected. But the point is, there are ripple effects that go out when somebody not only buys but flies a G5, and you have aircraft and power plant mechanics that have work, and that's a very well-paid profession. And you have other people, fuelers and people who do, like you say, do tertiary work, like wash the airplanes. What it does is it creates a tremendous amount of jobs for throughout the economy when somebody buys a jet.
Without a doubt, that spending trickles down to everybody. And those sort of jobs end up going out and buying groceries, and they end up dining in our restaurants, and they buy a new car from Jim Click, and so on and so forth. And so that process continues. Governor Hobbs seems to really like to pick luxury items and pick on her tired example of this piano on the ESAs. Like, how many
right.
times can she use that excuse? Every time I see her speak publicly, it's this talk of pianos. Like, you would think that in some way, shape, or form, like piano futures would be even greater than G5 futures out there in the tertiary
Grant,
effects of
this. I gotta tell you, piano tuner lives matter.
Right, absolutely. They all do. They all do. Well, we appreciate you calling in over here, Charles. Thanks for spending part of your Wednesday morning with us and listening as always. We appreciate you, my man. And we appreciate all our listeners over here on The Morning Voice. It's great to get to talk about these sort of things once in a while here in the Old Pueblo, because that trickle effect really is going to change the lives of all of us on here. As I talked to Grover Norquist, like those changes in tax code for both qualified business income deduction and accelerated depreciation, I get it. Deep accounting nerdery, right? Not things that are going to gain radio listeners. People are switching channels as we speak when I bring up modified accelerated cost recovery.
Do depreciation system. Schedules, Grant.
Let's do it. It's so exciting. But this makes a huge difference about whether you're going to buy that equipment this calendar year or not, or next year, or even do projects like that in the first place. And as Charles said, that then trickles down to purchases of goods and services and feeds everybody in the economy. As someone that grew up in Detroit, let me tell you what happens when the manufacturing facilities shut down in your town. It is a tremendous trickle-down effect affecting the local grocer, the butcher, the shopkeep, the restaurateur, the schools, the municipal government, absolutely all of it. And so we've got to do whatever we can do to help support local businesses and jobs in the Old Pueblo. It is one of the things that I love to shepherd and carry forward here on The Morning Voice. It's one of the reasons that I get to have this opportunity to spend Wednesday mornings with you. And I appreciate all of you for taking time out of your schedule and spending your Wednesday morning with me. We're going to have a great show coming up for you next week. We've got Kathleen Wynn coming up today at 9 o'clock.
China Watch and Nate Foster with the Tucson Police Protective League.
Right. He's got a lot to say, I'm sure, about everything.
Tom Moulton's going to take a zip lining tomorrow, Grant.
No way. I want to go zip lining. I'm into it. Let's get it.
We stipulated yesterday, Tom has to go first.
Yes, I want to watch that one as well, too. We'll have to put that one on the podcast for sure. Thank you all for spending part of your Wednesday morning with us. It was a great hour with Paul Perez and with Grover Norquist. Looking forward to having more important discussions with you on local food, restaurant, and business talk on The Morning Voice. See you next week.